Welcome to Act and Unwind, an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. I'm your host, Eric Cohn. I want to thank you for listening, and I want to ask that if you're listening to us on our website, that you navigate right now to the show notes for this episode. That's where you'll find a link to subscribe directly to Act and Unwind at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else where you listen to fine podcasts. And if you like this program, please leave us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts so as to help more people find our show. This week, I'm joined by Noah Gould, Acton's Alumni and Student Programs Manager, and David Hebert, Affiliate Scholar and Managing Editor of the Journal of Markets and Morality here at Acton. This week, we'll be discussing industrial policy, and if the only problem with it all along was that people just weren't doing it right. There's a new minimum wage law for fast food workers taking effect in California. The consequences there might be unintended, but they're also completely expected. And Sam Bankman-Fried has been sentenced to 25 years in prison for his financial crimes. Is this justice? But first, the topic that was unaddressed last week on our podcast, but has been squatting right here and staying, refusing to leave, is this issue about squatters' rights that if you follow the news closely, you may have seen popping up on a semi-regular basis. To give you a little bit of background on this, there's a very good piece by Riley Stevens in the Dispatch this morning that we will put in the show notes. I'll give you a little bit of the intro of that to set all of this up. Adele Andaloro says she was simply trying to remove squatters who had taken up residence in a home she owned, yet she was the one who got arrested last month after she called the police. The New York incident is just one story among many drawing attention to, quote, squatters' rights, people settling themselves into a vacant home and claiming legal entitlement to remain indefinitely. Technically, squatters' rights do not exist. No law purports to intentionally protect squatters, and property owners theoretically have a constitutionally protected right to exclude unwelcome visitors from their property. Rather, squatters' rights refer to and often conflate two different things: adverse possession and the abuse of ostensibly legitimate tenant protections by bad actors. Under the traditional legal doctrine of adverse possession, occupying a property for a sufficient length of time can convey ownership. This is no new or novel policy idea. The basic concept can be traced all the way back to the Romans. But nor does it come into play in the vast majority of squatter cases featured in the news or on social media, because the requirements for adverse possession are typically steep. New York requires the adverse possessor occupy the land for 10 years. California only requires 5. Maryland requires 20. And there are usually additional requirements. In New York, the adverse possessor must produce documentation purporting to entitle them to the property, such as a deed they thought was legitimate but turns out to be invalid. Some jurisdictions counterintuitively require that adverse possessor act in bad faith, rewarding deliberate thieves, but not those who honestly but mistakenly believe they owned the land. California's relatively lenient 5-year minimum only applies if the squatter has been covered, has been covering the property taxes. So as it notes in this intro, there's kind of a combination of things going on here. I think one of the interesting questions is this gets to a clear question of property rights and how is it possible that people who do not own a property can basically show up, set up residence, and then become impossible to evict. So, as Riley Stevens here points out, this doesn't really exist in the form that it's being talked about. But I think this raises another interesting question as well. If it comes to exist by the way it is handled from the point of view of a legal system, it kind of does exist, whether there's been a law written for it or not. Because again, as the intro story mentioned, there's a woman trying to get people out of property she owns, and she's the one who gets arrested. Now, one could try to dismiss this as just major cities having gone crazy. I am reminded again of the great quote from Nat Glaser of sometime around in the 1960s, cities stopped doing the things that they know how to do, like pick up the trash, and decided to do things that no one knows how to do, like solve poverty. I think you could probably draw some kind of line from that thinking about how to run major cities to problems like this, where people who may clearly own property can't get others who don't own it and won't leave out of their property. Noah, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, it's clearly a problem, and this is kind of a, like I said, it's kind of an interesting point to me that squatters' rights in and of themselves don't really exist, but in the practice of law and governance in a major city like New York, where we're reading a lot of these stories out of, it kind of does. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I think I have a little bit of a different take on this. So what's interesting about this story is I think it reveals that ownership is more complicated than we think about it, usually in the kind of common parlance. So if we think about adverse possession, that is a really old tradition of possessing something is part of owning it. It's not all of owning it, but it is a piece. So that I think is actually an important concept in kind of private property law that kind of has been discovered over time in the common law tradition, is that to kind of own a piece of land, you have to possess it and be using it in some way to continue to possess it over time. So if you kind of think about two farmers, one of them kind of gives up and moves to the city and leaves his land fallow, and then the other farmer builds a fence and excludes a part and uses it for 10, 15, 20 years. You know, it's different state by state and per jurisdiction. But that is a helpful way to say, okay, if this person has used it open and notoriously is the language of the law, then they can keep it. Now, I think what's happening here is a conflation of tenants' rights, which are important part of, you know, kind of protecting people where they live, and this idea of just you can take somewhere and then you have those same rights if you're just kind of breaking and entering and living somewhere for a place. So that it is just a conflation of a bunch of different ideas. But this adverse possession tradition underlying, I think, is important. We shouldn't disregard it.
Dave, feel free to jump in on any of this. But as Noah pointed out, there's and having lived in the city of Chicago for 15 years, as I did, I'm aware of, fairly aware, rented for the entire time that I was there. There are a lot of protections for renters on that side of it. And I think you, from a kind of cultural conversation too, you do see this demonization of landlords. A great example of where people don't realize the value that, you know, it kind of in the same way that we just disparage middlemen all the time, because you look at it just kind of on a surface level and it's like, well, why does this person exist to mediate some kind of a transaction between me and someone else? And the answer from an economics perspective would be they're there for a reason. They're not there just because. And I'll throw this in real quick here just to give people an idea. If you're not familiar with some major cities out there, the extent to which that they protect the rights for people who are tenants and renters. The District of Columbia, for instance, has extensive protections for tenants under the Bill of Rights for DC tenants. You cannot be asked to leave simply because your lease expired. In most circumstances, existing tenants are protected and rent controlled, such that a tenant is more or less entitled to a new lease, and the landlord cannot increase the rent more than 2% or an existing tenant. On an existing tenant, and then only 10% when the apartment changes over. This is why many newer buildings try gimmicks such as 13-month lease with 1 month free, and that discount is prorated across the lease term such that the tenant pays a lower monthly rent while the landlord gets a higher nominal rent with which to calculate the rent-controlled increases. It creates the incentive to play these kinds of games. And maybe things don't often work out the way that they were intended when these laws were written.
Yeah, I mean, I think these laws and the consequences of them, such that we're seeing today, are a perfect example of, you know, an unintended consequence. Clearly, no one meant to say, you know, hey, if you live in this house for a month, you can be guaranteed housing for the next 6, 12, 24 months without any consequences. Clearly, no one intended anything like that. And yet, that seems to be some of the results. Now, thankfully, and I think it's fair to point this out, thankfully, this issue is fairly small. you know, there's not a whole, there's not millions of renters who are abusing this system left, right, and center. So it's, to me, it's not a national security crisis or anything to that extent, but it is a problem. And it is something that I think is going to get worse as we see, you know, more and more people gaming the system in these weird ways with 13-month rent and everything like that. So I do think it is a problem. I'm not trying to downplay it or make it sound less severe, but, you know, if this was in the thousands of cases per year, I'd be pretty surprised. But, you know, it is a big problem. And it does speak to the difficulty of what is a property right? What does ownership actually mean? You know, so when I was renting, I owned the right to live in the unit. That's true. I didn't own the right to change the thermostat, as I found out when I tried to do that once, and my landlord got really mad at me. So, turns out I didn't have access to the utility panel, so I couldn't shut off the electricity, and then that's dangerous, and there's problems, right? So so I had several rights that come with, you know, owning, I suppose you could say, but I didn't have all the rights, and the landlord clearly retains all those rights. And that's where I think the difficulty comes in is, you know, what does it mean to say, you know, hey, you can't be here anymore? The intent of a lot of these laws are noble. You know, who could argue against trying to protect people who might not be in the best situation financially or in terms of experience with, you know, tenant law, mm-hmm. right? The landlord has dealt with, you know, probably at least a few tenants before. Tenants may have only dealt with one or two landlords, right? And so they're not going to have as much knowledge about the law as the landlord is, right? So we might want to protect them in that case. It's also probably the case that the landlord has significantly more resources to throw at disputes, right, than the tenant does. So, okay, we might want to protect them there too. Mm-hmm. But there are instances where protections can go too far. And I think this is where, in a lot of cities and a lot of states, I think this is a case where those protections may have gone too far and into a realm of abuse.
Yeah, we got to think about like what type of behavior do we want to incentivize for kind of the stock of housing. And I think you bring up a really good point of there are different interests that we need to balance. There is the interest, and we don't want people to have one day notice for all their stuff on the street. Sure, great. We also want to incentivize upkeep of housing. That's a big problem right now. We don't have the incentives aligned so that renters don't trash apartments, don't destroy value of housing, that kind of thing. So I think when we use just a pure emotional reasoning, we end up with a real unbalance on the laws and rules. And we got to be careful about how do we balance these different interests to create the right incentives so we don't have these wacky unintended consequences.
To me, this is redolent of the way that we have so deeply messed up housing policy, particularly in major cities, but you see problems with this really all over the country. You have a combination of problems that are the result, I think, of public policy choices, and it is multiplied by issues like the ones that we are talking about right now. So in the New York City mix, another problem that you can throw into it is New York City has had rent control for a good long while, and there was – I will try to find it, but there was a recent story of, you know, this woman talking about basically how she's been able to, you know, live her life in a way to explore the things she loves and cares about because she's been paying like in the hundreds of dollars for an apartment in New York City, which anybody who knows anything about housing rates in New York City, apartment rental rates in New York City, it is in the thousands of dollars. I mean, you will get jokes about you can only rent like a closet in Manhattan for like $3,500 a month. And so you have this goes to what you were saying, Noah, of, you know, one of the things, again, the unintended consequences, the unseen part of this is the lack of the housing that is not constructed because landlords, people who would be profiting off of owning a building with units like that, are limited in what they can actually take in because of rent control policies. And talk to people who have, you know, lived in those kinds of units. On one hand, in most cases, they will acknowledge that, yes, it's fantastic that they know that their rent can only go up by a little bit from year to year to year, which also creates this weird thing in New York City where there are a lot of people when they're shopping for a new apartment, you know, do not look in the typical places you would expect. You know, you used to browse on Craigslist or like apartments.com. Do you know where people look? The obituaries. You're looking for people who owned or had lived in rent control apartments that died and they're now going to be free. They're going to be open. You have it is too difficult to build new units in many cities and in, you know, places that aren't major cities as well. Even here in Grand Rapids, we're the second largest city in Michigan. I read a piece recently. We have something like a 96% occupancy rate for the housing in Grand Rapids. You also have this phenomenon of a lot of boomers who are not moving out of the housing that they are have been occupying for quite a while. So you have this long occupied, many of them having paid off their mortgages, of housing that is not coming back on the market. It is difficult to build new housing. I will give a sop here to some of the people who, you know, like to make those points about, like, you know, back in the 1950s, you could on one income, you know, send your kids to college and own a house and do yada, 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 yada. One of the points I do think is reasonable is it is hard to build housing the size that you had in the 1950s anymore because of certain, I guess, you know, requirements, and what is viewed as being profitable, again, given the restrictions that exist on how much housing you can build and where. So it just to me is this is a combination of so many policy failures, so many attempts to do one thing one place without a whole lot of attention being paid to the other places where there are negative externalities, where there are negative impacts on the market. And this is how you can have situations like, as I observed in Chicago, where you would see new apartment buildings opening all the time. And the kind of base level understanding of the economics of it would suggest that, like, if you're adding new units, the prices should start coming down, and they never do. They never. It continues to be just as expensive. And the combination of laws by effect, as again, as we noted, there aren't really squatters' rights, but this is a combination of kind of an adverse selection of public policy choices, continue to just make these markets messy and expensive when they don't need to be. But we've kind of chosen but not directly to have this kind of situation.
Yeah, a great piece kind of grappling with some of the moral aspects, which I highly recommend, is Rachel Ferguson wrote a piece in Religion and Liberty Online. She titled it "Why Christians Should Be, in parentheses, the Best Landlords." So kind of defending both this idea that Christians can be landlords and add value, and with the acknowledgement that they have to have ethics and they should be the best landlords because they can actually bring in that aspect to their work and protect people, but defending kind of engaging in the marketplace and the value add. It's a great piece. I recommend it.
We'll put that in the show notes so people can check it out. I want to move on because we can try to do some quick hits. We're going to try to get through four topics today on the podcast. So I want to move on to this piece that appeared in the Washington Post from U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, who represents Florida in the United States Senate, the headline of which is "Why I Believe in Industrial Policy Done Right." I'll give you a little bit from the beginning here. When I first came to Washington in 2011, industrial policy were dirty words. Democrats and Republicans alike viewed pro-manufacturing laws and regulations with almost religious suspicion. Today, that has started to change, although what replaces unfettered free trade remains hotly debated in Congress. I believe our country needs industrial policy to rebuild our manufacturing sector, which has suffered decades of neglect and unfair competition. I also believe the Biden administration has done industrial policy wrong, throwing vast sums of money at questionable projects and arguably empowering communist China in the process. Some will eagerly use the administration's failures to tarnish those of us who believe in a smart, common sense approach to industrial policy. But let me set the record straight about what industrial policy is, what it isn't or shouldn't be, and how it has been used successfully in the past. And from there, he goes into his attempt to detail those. So, Dave, I'll throw the question to you. Has the problem with this all along just been that we just haven't been smart about it?
Right. So I always kind of get a little irritated at these kind of headlines and introductions where it says, you know, hey, I support doing, you know, what I'm going to call egregious policy move if it's done right. right? Or think about, you know, anytime you've heard, you know, we're going to use smart technology, right? Smart grids. I'm like, okay, so the other grids are dumb, other technology is dumb, and previous policymakers were dumb. Got it. Okay, got it. So everyone in all of human history has been wrong up until Marco Rubio, and so we're going to do it right this time, right? And so that's the thing that bothers me about these is the rhetoric is always, you know, at some level, unassailable and unimpeachable. Of course you want to do things when they're done right. That's a dumb statement, right? It's trivially true. The question that I think we should be asking is, like, what would be good industrial policy, right? What would that even look like? And here I am again using the word good as opposed to, you know, bad, right? Mm-hmm. And here's kind of the thing. Industry has changed in the world, right? We have lots of new, like, not new countries, but new technologies, new abilities. Places are getting wealthier. And so the ability to work together in a peaceful and cooperative way and to ship things around the world and to work in a multi-step, multinational production process. I mean, think about how textiles are made. Typically, we see the cotton grown in the American Southeast. It is then shipped over to Taiwan to be processed. Then sometimes it's shipped back to the U.S. to be turned into actual garments or things like that. Sometimes the garments are made overseas. That's true. We even see, in some cases, it's shipped from the American Southeast down to South America to be processed into thread, and then the thread is shipped over to Asian countries over there and turned into garments and then shipped back to the U.S. All that is done because it's actually cheaper and it's actually greener for the country to do it that way too. And so, and the world, frankly. And so, to me, getting these things right is relatively simple. And I think Milton Friedman said it best. You know, anytime there is a free trade or an industrial policy agreement that's more than a page long, you know there's something weird in there, right? It should be really easy. Do things that you are good at, be productive, sell it to people who can do things better, right? And there you go. That should be the easiest one. Instead, we try to complicate this and say things like, oh, well, you know, we're going to create jobs. It's like, yeah, you're going to move jobs from where they would have been to this new sector. True. Is that going to be a net gain in jobs? Unlikely. It's going to be more expensive. And so, no, when you have things that are more expensive, you get less of them. And so that doesn't seem to be true. So I get really bothered by statements like this where, you know, hey, we're going to do it right. Like, okay. We've been trying for a few hundred years. This is the time. Now's the day we're going to get it right. Okay.
I think one of the kind of humorous parts of this article is when he says, you know, the real problem with Biden's CHIPS Act is lobbying.
And it's a bit rich coming from the coming from the senator of the sugar industry.
Yeah, on one level, I agree. That's what went wrong with it. Great. Yeah, lobbyists don't just wear blue ties.
Yeah.
There's lobbyists on both sides of the aisle on this issue, and I mean there's a real public choice critique of this is what happens every time you have a large-scale intervention like this. It doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican. There's going to be a huge amount of capture by the industries. I struggle to see what's going to be different about his kind of proposed pet policies. I wrote a piece in the National Review when the CHIPS Act was first passed, basically saying, yeah, this is just a huge handout to Intel and the other chips makers. And what Rubio seems to want, he says, you know, we need to support critical industries like mining, oil, and gas. Okay, this is just going to be handouts to his favorite industries. So it's just kind of a switch. And I worry that there's this kind of bipartisan consensus about we need to really do industrial policy, which just ups the quota of the amount of money that's available for capture every single year. There's always money in the government that's going to be available to capture for government, you know, for businesses to try to get over producing profit and value. But this is every year we just have a lot of money on the line that every industry can kind of fight for.
I will start with where I will give Marco Rubio and those like him a little bit of credit, which is there are some very specific industries in which I think you can make a compelling argument that there are national security interests to have the supply chains for a lot of military equipment. I think you can even make a compelling argument about some kinds of medicine running primarily through the United States versus, say, you know, how much do we want to depend on technology from China that feeds into a lot of military equipment. You know, okay, I can at least understand that. We can have a conversation along those lines, the extent to which we should engage in policy that subsidizes those particular industries is up for debate. But I think there is a credible argument to be made there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but and let's be even more specific than that. I think the national security language sometimes, I mean, if in some sense, toothpaste is a national security because if people have bad teeth,
abused,
then we
would. Undeniably.
So I think it's more helpful to maybe say like military capabilities.
I think it's a good point.
Yeah.
What this reminded me of is I'm going to give you a quote that you know you guys are either going to recognize or not, and if it's not, I will slap you about the head and shoulders a little bit later. Danny, there's a lot of badness in the world today. I see it in court today. I've sentenced boys younger than you to the gas chamber. Didn't want to do it, but felt I owed it to them. The most important decision you can make right now is what do you stand for, Danny? Goodness or badness? This Judge Smalesian way of looking at economic policy as if the problem has always been, we made bad decisions up until now. It is hilarious to me that Rubio here is simultaneously judging people who are engaging in the same type of policy decisions but with different political agendas as just having their intentions were wrong. But his intentions are good, which of course means that his results are going to be good in his mind. I mean, this is one of the great mistakes of public policy in the history of public policy making is to judge these things by the intentions of the people who crafted them rather than the actual outcomes that they produce. The irony here would be that like Rubio so clearly identifies that, you know, the kinds of things that the Biden administration, or if you want to go back to when Marco Rubio was first elected to the United States Senate during the Obama years. Does anybody remember Solyndra and a lot of the green energy subsidies that the Obama administration was engaging in? What he's fundamentally pointing out is that he has a political difference in what he thinks is valuable. So in a way, he's being a little bit honest about what he wants to do here, which is the, you know, I guess I could get Schmittian about it if I wanted to. He wants to reward his friends and punish his enemies. I've always appreciated the people who have come around lately who have been pretty nakedly obvious and honest about that point, that they want to reward people that they think deserve being rewarded and they want to punish people that they think deserve being punished. It's honest. It's horrifying to me, but at least it is honest. The idea, and this is another one of those, you know, you get the flags of these things, I think, very quickly and very early on. In the first paragraph that I read to you, today that has started to change, although what replaces unfettered free trade remains hotly debated in Congress. Get out of here with your unfettered free trade nonsense. You know, I'm perfectly willing to have an argument about the current state of all of this stuff. And recognize that the kind of policy that's being formulated is not the kind of policy that Marco Rubio would desire to see if he is also willing to be intellectually honest about the idea that what we have, if you know, we have these, as you pointed out, free trade agreements that go on forever with all these clauses and all these different rules, which is not free trade. It is some managed form of trade. It is one of these red flags that similarly to how every time I hear somebody say market fundamentalism, I know I'm not engaging with somebody who's making a serious argument. There are very few people who are, you know, this gets thrown at us at Acton quite honestly, which just shows to me that people don't, the people who are saying it haven't closely examined or even done a cursory examination of a lot of the work that we do here at the Acton Institute. There are very few people who are in any way meaningfully market fundamentalists, just as the idea that we have some kind of unfettered free trade is a joke. I'm happy to have this argument, but can we at least be honest about the parameters of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's useful to think about, you know, the debate about unfettered free trade. So in the U.S. and in other countries as well, there's a whole field of import tax engineering where the goal is to figure out how you can change a product ever so slightly such that it's taxed at a much lower rate. And one of the classic examples, and I hear this all the time, is, you know, women's clothing don't have pockets typically. Do you know why? Pockets come with higher taxes, and women are more willing to forego forego pockets and instead carry a satchel or a purse than men seem to be. If men suddenly woke up tomorrow and said, hey, we're going to carry a big bag around with us to hold all our stuff instead of putting in our pockets, I bet you our pockets would become decorative just like theirs. The same is true for Truly and other forms of seltzer-based beer products or alcohol products. Those are technically beer. The reason why it's beer and not a vodka soda is because it's brewed with hops. Why do we brew it with hops? Because hops make it legally beer. Beer is taxed at a much lower rate. So the rise of things like Truly and all these other, you know, new vodka soda tasting beverages is not surprising. It's an avoidance of taxes. That's all it's been. And that is a result of trade policy. And so what we're doing is, again, circling back to the discussion in the landlord debate, what you want to think about when you're enacting policy is what sorts of activities are you encouraging and what sorts of activities are you discouraging, right? I think, and maybe this is me being cheeky, that we should encourage productive activity that is in the service of others. I think that would be a laudable goal. But these policies that Rubio and others, right, and on the left and the right seem to purport or to advance, seem to be subsidizing or encouraging activity that maybe we don't want to see more of.
Yeah. Back to the point that I made, again, a little cheekily, but I will expand on just for a moment here before we move on. Marco Rubio is a regular and consistent proponent of the massive subsidies that the sugar industry gets, in part because of how concentrated it is in Florida, and that is the state that he represents. Okay, so if you want to dive into that issue, you know, that is making things more expensive than they need to be. The necessity of subsidizing sugar? Sugar? Really? Sugar? Okay, fine. Marco, you want to have this conversation? Let's begin by examining whether or not sugar subsidies are industrial policy done right. And I'm pretty sure you're going to find that that is, oh no, that's one we've been doing right all along. Sure it is. And just a weird coincidence that it happens to benefit people who more or less live in your state and that you represent. So again, back to the point I made, I appreciate the people who are at least being willing to be honest about the effects of this and the parameters in which we should be engaging in it. I don't believe that Marco Rubio or some of the other people who are making these kinds of arguments are doing it. They're suggesting we can do it without any trade-offs, without any negative consequences of these policies, and nobody should take that argument seriously. Speaking of another case where you're getting a lot of negative consequences that were both predictable, but people are pretending to be shocked by, I'll read to you here from an editorial in the Wall Street Journal. California Governor Gavin Newsom's higher minimum wage for fast food workers takes effect Monday. This has been a couple weeks ago. On top of California's already high $16 minimum wage, the minimum wage for fast food workers will increase to $20 an hour, the highest minimum wage in the U.S. Minimum wage advocates parrot the claim that this is a win for fast food workers. They cite a few studies to argue that those workers will earn more and suffer no job losses and that poverty will fall. But a growing body of research demonstrates that the small number of studies advocates rely on are flawed. The favorite study of minimum wage advocates, which is also the most germane to California's situation, is David Card and Alan Krueger's 1994 study of the fast food industry in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. This study claimed not only that there was no job loss when New Jersey raised its minimum wage, but also that New Jersey fast food employment rose substantially. On its own, this baffling conclusion should have been enough to arouse suspicion. Subsequent research I did, so this is a piece written by David Newmark. Subsequent research I did with William Washer established the data flaws from a poorly designed telephone survey were responsible for the dubious findings. Fast food franchisees' payroll records showed that fast food employment fell, with each 10% increase in the minimum wage reducing employment by nearly 2%. Again, we'll put that piece in the show notes for people to peruse. Dave, you're an economist. Why don't you unpack the economics around these kinds of minimum wage increases? Because we, on one hand, frequently do hear these kinds of arguments that, like, there are studies that show that the impact on employment is minimal, if not positive, or at least, you know, there's kind of a non-existent impact on the total amount of employment here. But on the flip side, I think, you know, people would what strains credulity to me is when you take these arguments to what would be the logical conclusion. So, okay, if $20 is good, isn't $40 better? Isn't $80 better than that? And everybody will agree at some point that it was like, well, that's too much. Okay, why? And they'll make the point that was like, well, it's more than people would be willing to pay, so you'd start losing jobs. Okay, do you think that applies, if not at least just marginally, to the kinds of increases that you're suggesting?
Yeah, so minimum wage legislation is such a hot topic issue, and every labor economist at some point in their life will study it at least a little bit. It's one of those things that you can always find a new natural experiment to go test, and usually it'll get published, because usually what you find if you do the study is you find that there's not a whole lot of unemployment caused by raises in minimum wage. Now, I have to caveat that heavily. And so this is also what happened in the Cardin-Kruger paper, and also has happened in nearly every instance of this. First off, almost all of the studies focus on the restaurant industry. The reason for that is fairly straightforward. They typically have the lowest minimum wage because they can also be paid at the tipped minimum wage, not just the minimum wage for, you know, normal or non-restaurant workers. So they focus there. Second thing that you see is when the minimum wage rises, what you tend to find is far fewer workers getting, for example, overtime pay. But the same amount of work still needs to happen. And so what employers will typically do is they will cut hours for all of their employees to avoid hitting that 40-hour threshold and starting having to pay, you know, time and a half for that. So they'll hire more workers because they need to have the same number of labor hours per week, but they need to make sure that none of their laborers get 40 hours, because now that's, you know, way more expensive. And so you do see, in some instances, in the very short run, workers or more workers being hired as a result of higher minimum wages. However, most people take home fewer dollars because they end up working fewer hours. And so you have sort of this conflating effect. In the medium to long term, what you end up seeing are changes in the composition of the workforce that is being employed. So I'll use fast food, as almost every study does. So in 2011, McDonald's and plenty of other fast food restaurants started experimenting with touchscreen technology, right? Why did they start experimenting with touchscreen technology? Well, if you can have a touchscreen that allows you to set up a big kiosk in the lobby of your restaurant and allow customers to come in and order their food themselves, right? Now all of a sudden you don't need to have someone there to take the order, right? Okay. As the price of touchscreens have fallen, as the price of LCD screens and, you know, internet and, you know, ability to communicate between the terminal where the customer is interacting and the kitchen itself, as that all becomes cheaper, suddenly typing in an order becomes very easy if you can use it, you know, if you can use technology to do it instead of a person. And so in the medium to long term, what you see as a result of minimum wage laws is this substitution away from hiring workers and toward hiring machines. I'll keep going with the fast food industry. So in the late 90s, it was very common to see someone filling up a basket of French fries and then putting that basket into the hot oil. Today, that's done by a machine. Right, there's an actual hopper that someone loads a giant bag of French fries, of frozen French fries, into. That machine will portion it out into hoppers or into baskets. Right, then the baskets will move along a conveyor belt, go into the oil, right, come out perfectly cooked and dumped into the big receptacle where someone will scoop it and put it into the bag. Right, well, that's three jobs right there that have been at some level eliminated by this robot. right? We see the same thing at drive-thrus. Next time you go through a drive-thru, watch and see if someone's actually pouring you your soda. They're not. There's a machine there. It even is fancy enough to, you know, dispense a whole bunch of it, stop, let the bubbles pop, and fill it back up a little bit more and top it off. So now we don't even have someone topping off your drink. A robot is doing that. Look at grocery stores and other, you know, mega stores like Walmart, you know, all the other Meijer in our area. What do you see? Self-checkout lanes. Why? Well, because we all know how to use a checkout machine, right? And so now one person can do the job of 8, 12, sometimes even 25 cashiers. And so all of this is a direct result of two factors. One is the falling price of computers. There's no disputing that technology has gotten cheaper over the last 25, 30, 40 years. That's easy. But what's interesting to me is to see where is technology making the biggest inroads the fastest. And that is in industries that are primarily minimum wage workers. And it's in areas that are primarily, it's primarily in areas where minimum wage hikes are the largest. So New York City, San Francisco, Michigan, right? We're seeing these new things called, you know, touchscreen kiosks at fast food restaurants popping up a lot faster. I was just making my way through from here to Georgia, right? A few weeks ago, we went to McDonald's because I have two young kids. Those McDonald's didn't have touchscreens. It was weird. Even my four-year-old commented and said, "Daddy, where's the touchscreen?" He didn't call it a touchscreen. He called it a big iPad. But, you know,
yeah.
Such is life. But
He's not wrong.
He's like, "Where are they?" I'm like, "I don't know. Maybe they're not here yet." Mm-hmm. Why? Well, we'll save that for a later date for Wesley. But it's to me, it's very clear. When you have a higher minimum wage, you're going to see employers trying to substitute away from workers and toward machines. The answer is simple. Machines are cheaper. Mm-hmm. They work 24 hours a day. You don't have to pay them overtime. They break down, sure, but you can fix them.
I think to tie this into our last story with the Rubio piece, it's interesting in the California minimum wage bill, the kind of uproar about chains that have bakeries bake their own bread are exempted from this minimum wage rule. And the tie-in with Panera is quite interesting. Panera now claims that they will not, they will pay $20 an hour for their restaurants. But it's an interesting kind of public choice angle to this. Which stores, which restaurants are fast food? How do you count that? What do you do for a grocery store that has a restaurant inside it? Does that count? So there's all these kind of little carve-outs that businesses are trying to make to try to kind of get away from being counted in this minimum wage. Another interesting angle is we're going to have a combination of lower take-home pay for the number of hours people work, but also there's a way in which some of these minimum wage laws end up passing some of the costs on to the consumers, not just on the kind of bottom line of the cost you're paying. But if you think about doing the self-checkout line, that is a type of labor that the buyer, the consumer, actually now has to do instead of the employee of the restaurant, typing in your order on the McDonald's screen, going back and forth 14 times between all the options. That's a labor that you are doing instead of the employee. So there's also a way in which I think there might be a pushback from consumers on the ways in which labor has now been transferred to them.
That is an interesting point. And the I was actually thinking about it from the other perspective, which is anybody who orders, you know, doesn't want to order just the fast food meal the way that it exactly mm-hmm. comes. If you want to make right. any customizations, it is a way to reduce the error that comes along with it. Of course, the error can still be introduced from somebody making it wrong, but more often than not, that comes from somebody entering the order wrong or misunderstanding what you are asking for. This at least allows you to go through, customize it, verify what you want before pressing the order button on all of that. You know, I think we have this predilection towards looking at these problems in the moment that they exist, without an idea of a long-term view of, you know, where we're going, where we've come from, where we are now, and where it is going to, and that there are shifts within the labor market as we reallocate away from areas that are proving to be less valuable and towards areas where there is more value. And the The problem is, particularly as it confronts politicians, is they care about the here and now. And it's very hard to tell people that it was like, well, we're shifting to what will be, you know, something better. You get a lot of this in the rhetoric about a lot of company towns that are industrial towns in the Midwest, like in the Rust Belt, that have been hollowed out. And it necessitates these conversations about, well, okay, well, what do we do for these kinds of people in these periods of transition? And there are, you know, a combination. The problem that I find in when I listen to people who are complaining about this is that, you know, it's kind of they want everything all at once. They want a period of time that doesn't exist anymore. They want to reinvest in these kinds of manufacturing jobs. So they don't want the evolution away, the technological evolution away from the way things were into a different future that points to people who used to do these jobs and say there's, you know, it's just not as valuable anymore. Need to find a way to transition to something else. But we also are heavily discouraging of the idea of people moving out of a lot of these towns. And I know Kevin Williamson is taking a lot of flack for this, but the more often than not, you know, he wrote this great piece, so I'll find it and put it in the show notes, about Garbutt, New York, that the conclusion is get up and move out of Garbutt. Go somewhere else where there is more going on, where there are more opportunities. And I do find this to be kind of fascinating that it is, on one hand, never been easier to move. And people are doing it less frequently than they used to. And I think it would do as well to start examining and understanding the reasons why those kinds of things are happening. A lot of it may have to do, or some of it may have to do, with an earlier topic that we were discussing, which is the availability of housing in different places. There's so many levels of policy complication. And again, this is where I would draw it back to the last topic we were discussing, which is all the people who formulated all of these policies thought they were doing it right. They thought they were doing good things. They thought they were helping people out. And they were helping some people, but they were doing it at the expense of others. And the understanding one needs to have, I think, about these things is there are no unalloyed goods. There is no policy you're going to construct that is going to have only the benefits and none of the downsides. And we should be a little more serious in discussing them. Minimum wage seems to be one of the most obvious cases where you can have these conversations. And I appreciate places like California letting this kind of thing play out so people can see what the consequences are and they can start drawing their own conclusions about it. Let us move on to our final topic of the day. We have discussed this story previously on this podcast. The founder of FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried, a couple weeks ago was sentenced to 25 years in prison for the fraud scheme that he perpetrated, and he was to pay $11 billion in forfeiture. No small amount of money there. Here from a piece in CNBC, FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced to 25 years in prison for the massive fraud and conspiracy that doomed his cryptocurrency exchange and related hedge fund Alameda Research. The sentence in Manhattan federal court was significantly less than the 40 to 50 years in prison that federal prosecutors wanted for Bankman-Fried, but it was much more than the 5 to 6.5 years suggested by his attorneys. Quote, there is a risk that this man will be in a position to do something very bad in the future, Judge Lewis Kaplan said before sentencing the 32-year-old and ordering him to pay $11 billion in forfeiture to the U.S. government. Quote, and that's not a trivial risk at all, Kaplan added. Kaplan noted that he never heard, quote, a word of remorse for the commission of terrible crimes from Bankman-Fried. The judge said in his 30 years on the federal bench, he had, quote, never seen a performance like Bankman-Fried's trial testimony. If Bankman-Fried was not, quote, outright lying during cross-examination by prosecutors, he was evasive, Kaplan said. Noah, I know you followed this story pretty closely. 25 years, does this seem like a justice to you?
This is interesting for white collar crime. It's somewhere in the middle of Bernie Madoff. We had 150 years, and recently Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes only 11 years. So it's kind of somewhere in the middle. What's really interesting that came out in the sentencing is kind of the long arm of perceived moral power. He wielded moral power at his company. This is the story that he told all of his employees. You know, we are doing this great thing for the world, and we're going to use this money to do the best good that we possibly can, which justified all of these cutting corners, all this outright fraud, stealing money, everything that happened there. I mean, it is billions of dollars of customer money that's just gone. And what was fascinating as we saw these statements come out from his friends, kind of petition the court, say, hey, here's a letter, character statement. A lot of people who were with him, who are employees, still thought he's well-meaning. They wrote these letters to the court. I read some of them that say, hey, please, you know, give him a lower sentence because he was well-meaning through all of it. And it's just—
altruism was literally written into the name of the philosophy he was espousing.
Yeah, effective altruism. It has a real dark side of it, justifies all of this behavior, because if you can do something that is towards the greater good, I should add, towards the greater good by your own calculation, right? That's a huge part of this whole puzzle. He was the calculator. He was the one who said, I have the moral calculus that I can give you, and we are doing good for the world. And so, and we saw that right down to the wire. His team said they plan to appeal it, so we'll see. But it's quite interesting to see how people have still defended him up till the very end.
What I have a hard time delineating as I look at this story is, on one hand, you see the kind of crimes that he was perpetrating. You see the things that he was doing. And you see people making those arguments like the ones that you were highlighting, Noah, where people think, like, you know, he's still good-natured, that he's still, you know, kind of a good person, was trying to do good things. And I think there's also a compelling argument that he is a far more malevolent person than we're giving him credit for. I think part of what was implied in the, I think, defense of him is that, you know, he's somewhere on the autism spectrum, that he's kind of got this, you know, didn't fully comprehend or understand the implications and the way that he was hurting other people. I don't know how persuaded I am of that. I think especially if you read the letter that his mother wrote, who was a professor in the School of Law at Stanford, and like their house had become this place where, like, on Sunday evenings they would have these salon type dinners where they would talk about, you know, progressive ideology. And, you know, I think there's something to the idea that he looked at all of these people and he saw right through them. And he saw an opportunity to, you know, using and adopting the kind of language that they would use to discuss their philosophy and the way they would like to see the world, to use that as a mechanism to take advantage of them, to get incredibly wealthy, and to do the kinds of things he wanted to do, thinking that there would be no consequences.
Yeah, I mean, unless he comes out and says, yes, I was malevolent this whole time, I don't think we'll ever know. But the connection with his mother's work is fascinating, because she argues against the idea of moral culpability, or that people can really be held accountable to their crimes because everything is determined. So I think a Christian perspective on fallenness really is helpful, because if you think that humans are just perfectly good, then you can maybe dance around, oh, did he not intend? But we know that everyone kind of has, as Solzhenitsyn says, the line of evil cuts through the human heart. Mm-hmm. So we know that this is just the reality. So that has, of course, he doesn't have perfect motives. That is part of the whole. Maybe he thought he was doing some good for the world, but he also thought he was the arbiter of that good. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty cushy for himself, his family, and his friends along the way. So there's certainly moral culpability here that we can look at and say, no, at any level, even if we allow at some level he thought he was doing what was right, he can't be perfectly altruistic and objective.
Yeah, there's also just very clear, if you followed this, the trial and the cross-examination that was mentioned in this CNBC piece, I mean, you do see a kind of remorselessness around this. And, you know, again, this is where I come back to where people have noted that he exists somewhere on the autism spectrum. I was like, you know, to the extent of which that he's, you know, if he feels it, if he's capable of manifesting it or not, you know, I don't know how important or relevant that is. But I mean, from the perspective of a judge who is going to pronounce a sentence on somebody like that, if you have come across through the entire thing of really thinking that you've done nothing wrong or that everything that you did was justifiable, that is going to lead inexorably to the kinds of conclusions that you heard from this judge, that if we, you know, if we go light on you, if we let you out, there's nothing to suggest to me that you aren't going to do it again. And in fact, some of the behavior that he engaged in while he was awaiting trial, where he was released on bond and he was living with his parents, but he was prohibited from accessing the internet, and he went ahead and did it anyway. I mean, there's something to suggest that this is someone who just does not believe that the rules of society, whether those are kind of the rules of convention or actual laws, apply to him in any meaningful way. In that sense, he becomes kind of this very, you know, this unique story, where you mentioned Bernie Madoff previously. And if you've read in depth about the Madoff story, you know, you can also see this pretty well played out. And there have been a couple of movies that have been made about it where you see, and again, you don't want to come away sympathetic to Bernie Madoff here. This is a man who perpetrated an awful crime on a whole lot of people. But the representation of, you know, the way that this did weigh on him, like the thing that he let, that he felt he let get out of control, the stress was weighing on him, the extent to which he was going to try to further it and to not have the entire thing collapse. And when it finally collapses, would he essentially confesses to his kids and his family what he had done. There is an understanding, you know, you can debate whether or not he was really remorseful about it, but there is at least an understanding of like, you know, I did something wrong. It got way out of control. And now it has resulted in this, you know, horrible set of consequences for me and a lot of harm to a lot of other people as well. And you just really didn't see any of that communicated from SBF in the course of his trial, in the way he's presented himself publicly. He seems to perceive himself as just being above all of it, which is why I kind of come back to sympathizing with the people making the argument that, you know, it's not this almost like childlike innocence in the way that he's approached these things, that it could be something more malevolent, that he just kind of he saw the nonsense of all of the people that his parents would host and the philosophy that his parents espouse, particularly your mother, his mother, as you noted, and just saw through all of it and decided he was capable of taking advantage of it. And he decided to do so.
Yeah, I think I would warn against viewing him as unique. Obviously, his height and what he reached is unique. But I worry that we are telling a whole generation of business leaders, all that matters is success and leveraging kind of social movements to get ahead in your business. And we don't have any kind of old-fashioned business responsibility that's just, hey, run your business well, make money, serve customers, and that's what you need to do. Instead, we have this kind of grand vision of business as all these different social problems, or really just pet political projects, and then you miss kind of the responsibility. So I think if we could stop viewing all these different business frauds, because they're mounting, there's a lot of them now, as unique and outliers, and start seeing them as a part of a pattern that we need to kind of start thinking about the culture of business differently, that would be a really good outcome of this story.
Let's call it a wrap there. Thank you for listening to Act and Unwind. If you're listening to this podcast on our website, please look in the show notes where you'll find a link where you can subscribe directly to Act and Unwind, or just search Act and Unwind on your favorite podcast app. Also, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, 5-star reviews only, so that more people can find this show. Thanks to Noah. Thanks to Dave. For the Acton Institute, I'm Eric Cohn. We'll see you next week.